Mental health care in America is very different from what it used to be. In general, we don't have the gigantic state hospitals that once warehoused mental patients by the thousands. But we also don't have an especially robust community mental health system, which is what was supposed to replace the old warehouse system. Our next guest finds plenty to dislike about the general state of the mental health care system. Bob Whitaker is a journalist. He's written 4 books about mental health in America, including Mad in America, which is also the name of the organization he heads. Bob Whitaker will lead a workshop on mental health in Medford in September and joins us today. Thanks for being here, Bob.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Is there an epidemic of mental illness?
Well, so I wrote a book with that title, Anatomy of an Epidemic, and what I was really looking at was the astonishing rise in the number of people on government disability due to mental illness. And so, for example, in 1987, we had about 1.25 million adults on disability saying they couldn't work because of, declared eligible because of a mental illness. And today we have about 5 million adults, so that's a fourfold increase. And so you have to ask why. Why is the burden of mental illness going up in our society so much? And we also get surveys that say about 25% of people every year suffer from a mental illness. We have about 20% of our adult population on psychiatric drugs. So certainly the burden of mental illness in our society is going up. We hear more about it, and more people are getting psychiatric care.
20%, you say, the adult population with psychiatric drugs?
Yeah, 12 and up take a psychiatric drug on a daily basis, which is rather astonishing.
That is. And so what kinds of drugs are we talking about here?
Well, antidepressants are the most popular drug, but a lot of people are on anti-anxiety drugs. Those are benzodiazepines. An increasing number of people are actually on antipsychotic drugs, using them for all kinds of conditions. And, of course, we have the stimulants for ADHD. Those are the 4 real main classes of drugs. And we are also getting anti-epileptic drugs known as mood stabilizers as well.
So is it that there is a greater identification of things as mental illness, or is there more mental illness? I mean, how do we get to a place where the increase is as sharp as what you're talking about?
Well, that's the good question, of course. Well, one of the things that has happened is, how do we define mental illness, and where do we draw the boundaries around what is, quote, normal and abnormal? And that is really done through the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is published by the American Psychiatric Association. And they clearly have been drawing boundaries ever outwards so that distress of any kind really can now get diagnosed as a psychiatric problem and get you a prescription. We have behaviors of children that are increasingly seen as psychiatric illnesses, you know, hyperactivity in classrooms, etc. So what we're really seeing of is that we do have a profession, and obviously it's supported by a pharmaceutical industry that has a desire to expand the boundaries of what we see as mentally ill and do some reconceptualization. So a lot of distress and difficulties that we used to see as just sort of ordinary problems in life, ordinary problems with growing up, have now been reconceptualized as psychiatric disorders. So that's one of the reasons we're seeing this great use of psychiatric drugs and this great expansion of people seen as mentally ill. It's a definition question and a way we judge ourselves.
As new drugs come onto the market, for example, do the old drugs go away as a bit of a cycling through, or is it an ever-expanding field from what you've found out?
Well, that's a great question. So one of the things that happened, and one of the reasons we have so much more use of psychiatric drugs, it really goes back to Prozac. Prozac gets introduced into the market in 1987 as a second-generation antidepressant, which is said to be so much better than the first generation of antidepressants. Now, actually, if you look at the science, the new drugs, in fact, weren't more effective than the old ones. Prozac is an SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, but it got marketed as this sort of miracle drug, so much better, so much safer and more effective. And then we got new antipsychotics, new benzodiazepines. So what you really see here is, in the science, you don't see really much progress from the first-generation psychiatric drugs to the second generation, but what you do see through direct-to-consumer advertising and all, a real promotion of these new drugs, and so that's what happened. We heard that Prozac was this miracle drug when science, in fact, wasn't telling that to be so.
Bob Whitaker is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a journalist who's written 4 books about psychiatric care in America. He'll be delivering a workshop in Medford next month called Rethinking Psychiatric Care, History, Science, and the Long-Term Effects of Psychiatric Medications. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange right here, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. When we talk about the psychiatric drugs that are out there, in addition to First of all, do you think they are being overprescribed?
It's any question they're being overprescribed. I mean, every drug, and it's not just psychiatric drugs, but I think psychiatric drugs certainly fall into this category. You know, every drug has risks and benefits, and really good medicine is about when to use them and using them cautiously. And we've thrown that caution to the wind. And here's the problem with psychiatric drugs. Once you go on a drug, that drug will change your brain. Your brain will try to compensate for its presence. And so once that happens, it can be difficult to get off the psychiatric drug. So my point is, going on a psychiatric drug is a pretty profound thing. It's going to change your brain. Your brain's going to become used to it, and getting off can become difficult. But these drugs are not prescribed with that sense of caution at all. So, yes, we have a huge problem with overprescribing. And I think if you conceive of psychiatric drugs in this way as something profound, you would be quite cautious about prescribing them to youth and to kids. But that caution isn't there as well.
So are you saying that the drugs ultimately end up doing more harm than good?
Well, first of all, they do change your brain, okay? So your brain will try to compensate for the presence of the drugs. And if we look at the scientific research, we see that the drugs generally sort of reduce the target symptom better than placebo, and that's why they get approved by the FDA. They have that short-term benefit. But what I did in a book called Anatomy of an Epidemic is look at a different question. What is science telling us about how these medications shape people's lives over the long term, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, and both on the target symptom but also about how well people are functioning? And when you take that perspective, you find a very different story. And whereas you do find that some people do fine on the medications, on the whole, they do appear to cause more harm than good. By that I mean they worsen long-term outcomes as compared to sort of natural recovery rates over the long term. You see that with depression. When you look at long-term studies of stimulants for ADHD, you do not see a benefit over the long term. And I think the most surprising place you see that is even in long-term studies of antipsychotics for schizophrenia and psychotic disorders, where we think that the value of the drugs over the long term is absolutely well established, you actually find that it is the patients who successfully get off the medications who have the better long-term outcomes, and particularly with regard to functional outcomes, cognitive function, and employment.
Let's take a call here. We have Mark in Reading on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bob Whitaker. We're talking about mental health care.
Yeah, I'd just like to comment that the man who started the whole ending of state mental hospitals and not paying for community services for mental patients spent the last 10 years of his life not knowing who he was.
And by that you mean?
Our illustrious governor of California and later president, Ronald Wilson Reagan.
All right. There is some, certainly can be some dispute about who is responsible for the deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill. That actually began before Reagan, didn't it, Bob Whitaker?
Sure. It dates back really to John F. Kennedy. The plan was set in motion in 1963 with a plan for reforming mental health care in this country. And then what really made it possible was the passage of Medicare and Medicaid laws, which said that if you discharge your patients, you run a state hospital, then the federal government will help pay for community care, whether it be in a nursing home or a group home, that sort of thing. So that was the legislation, and so it's 1965 when you start to see state hospitals begin discharging patients in large numbers. Now, that plan in the 1963 that was set up called for community care centers throughout the country, and we never fully funded them. So what we ended up with by the time Reagan came in, it was a lot of people living on the street because we did not set up the community care that we promised for, you know, more chronically ill patients. And we've never set up the proper community care, not really.
And these were supposed to be nursing homes specifically for psychiatric patients? There are a couple of different facilities I can imagine in community care, but is there really anything like this out there now? Bobby, there?
Yeah, I just lost you there. I didn't hear the question. I'm sorry about that.
All right, the question was just about the community care facilities that were meant to be set up under the idea of deinstitutionalization, and I imagine we have some of them, correct?
Yeah, there were some that were funded in the 1970s, and the idea was you could go there and be treated and get continuing therapeutic care, continuing prescriptions of your drugs, that sort of thing. But the number of centers were never fully funded. I think the number still operating has greatly decreased. And so what you really see in sort of society writ large is this. The chronic patient who gets discharged to a nursing home or gets discharged to a group home, what sort of real rehabilitation are they getting in terms of going back to work, that sort of thing? And so we really didn't put in place these rehabilitation programs that were going to say, okay, we're not going to just move institutionalization from the hospital to some group home setting, but we're going to really help people reintegrate into society. So we didn't build that sort of full-bodied, robust form of rehabilitation and recovery apparatus.
It sounds like it would have been a fairly labor-intensive system, where you need to have more people checking up on the welfare of psychiatric patients.
Well, you know, I think the thing here is this: is right now we sort of have conceived a sort of chronic care where people, whether they be in institutions or they be in group homes or something, where they remain wards of the state, so to speak. They remain under sort of a disabled condition. What you really want a system is that takes people who have a crisis, psychosis, mania, whatever it may be, and maximizes the possibility that becomes an episodic problem and you get them back into society in a full-bodied way, meaning working, etc. And that's part of our failure today, is we do not have a good system that takes that person in immediate crisis and helps them get it through that and return to a life where they're functioning and working and that sort of thing. Instead, we have a system right now that once you have that problem, conceives of it as necessarily a chronic problem, and then even encourages people often to go on disability and does not provide the support for really getting their full lives back, which means not needing government services. So a really robust system, in fact, will be more efficient in terms of government services because people won't, and not as many people will need them. That's our problem. And as more and more people end up on disability and in need of government services, well, then, of course, the services become stretched because states do not start finding they don't have the money to serve such a large population.
Bob Whitaker, the journalist who writes about mental health, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Leo in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question regarding early in this discussion the statistics of drugs being in the last 15 years and earlier things which are now classified as psychiatric conditions. Well, I'd like a comment on what Congress did towards the late 1990s, and consequently we've had 15 years of nonstop drug commercials on television. You know what I'm talking about, not just psychiatric.
All right, all kinds of stuff.
How does that factor into everything?
Okay, thanks, Leo. Appreciate it. Bob, thoughts?
Yeah, he's talking about direct-to-consumer advertising, which is not allowed in most countries of the world, in which you can advertise prescription drugs, and that has had a huge influence in increasing the number of people using psychiatric drugs, because, of course, we turn on our TVs, and these ads are funded by pharmaceutical companies. And next thing you know, basically the message we're being told is if you have a problem in life, some distress with your kid or yourself, well, you take a drug, go to your doctor, ask for a drug, and next thing you know, you'll be walking on a beautiful beach with a beautiful person and everything will be okay. So he's absolutely right. One of the reasons for this big expansion in our society and use of psychiatric drugs is because we have direct-to-consumer advertising. Pharmaceutical companies are able to, you know, basically, you know, sell their drugs on TV.
Ask your doctor if Zatzol is right for you and all that stuff. So,
exactly.
Yep. Okay, here's a call from Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bob Whitaker.
Yeah, hi. I completely concur with what Bob is saying. I have experienced I've worked in mental health facilities, and I've also utilized their facilities when I was college age. I went to a clinic, and they referred me to a community mental health center in. This was up in Michigan, and it was a wonderful place. It was a place where anybody could walk in, regardless of income, and find get services based on sliding scale, and the services were really good. Well, some 20 years later, I'm working in various mental health institutions, clinics, and agencies, and they are reduced to being basically warehouses for the chronically mentally ill who can barely function.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left the last job, the case managers had just been informed that their caseloads were being doubled, and this was in the early 2000s, and that that meant that they now had 15 minutes every 2 weeks to interact with every person on their caseload, which is barely enough time to say, are you taking your meds?
Okay, let's
go. That's the perspective.
All right, appreciate that. Thanks, Bob. I imagine you've heard stories like that lots.
Well, you hear this everywhere now, and it's a story that tells, you know, this is someone on the front line, so to speak. It tells of a broken system of care, completely broken. In fact, that we're just, you talked about a labor-intensive program. Well, we have so many people in need of services now that is happening because of our drug-based paradigm of care, and now we don't give them the type of real support, job support, other forms of sort of therapy, psychological therapies, helping them build friendships that people really need to get well. So he just described a system that's completely it's falling apart, is what he's describing, and we need to reinvent it.
So without a drug-based system, what becomes the center of care?
Well, you know, you can look, for example, this is one of the things, is where do we see people doing things better? And say with a new psychotic patients, new first episode psychotic patients, you can go to a place in northern Finland where they completely revamped their care in 1992, where they do use medications on a selective basis, trying to figure out for whom and for how long. But right in the beginning, when that young person has that psychotic episode, 19, 20, 21, 22, they throw a lot of resources at it. And one of the things is they meet with people, they do psychological sort of talk therapy, but they also bring in family members, friends, employers. And what they have done is completely transformed their outcomes with this intensive early psychological and social support, such that 80% of their first episode psychotic patients 5 years later are working or back in school and asymptomatic. Whereas you see in the United States, if you look at first episode psychotic patients, most 5 years later now are on the disabled list. So that's the difference. Spend up front with a lot of psychosocial support, and you can turn a lot of these problems into episodic problems.
There are models that work, and Bob Whitaker will talk about those more at his workshop, Rethinking Psychiatric Care, History, Science, and the Long-Term Effects of Psychiatric Medications in Medford, September 25th, welcomed by the Mental Health Resource and Education Network. Bob, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.